And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State versus Carla Montoya. Mr. Temple, good morning to you. You may proceed.
Good morning, members of the court, counsel. In 2012, the Nebraska legislature amended section 28707, the Nebraska statutes, and did so both purposefully and intelligently so as to create a classification of crime to punish those who unintentionally cause the death of a child while engaged in conduct that is reasonably likely to or possibly result in the death of a child. In 2016, Carla Montoya, the young mother, lost her temper with her four-year-old daughter at the time after the child was non-compliant, after refusing or being unable to follow directions. The mother, Ms. Montoya, like I said, lost her temper, threw the child into the bed area, wall, rail. It's not exactly clear where the child landed, but ultimately hit her head, resulting in a skull fracture, associated problems, and ended up passing away. The evidence before the court was unequivocally clear that there was no intent on the part of Ms. Montoya to cause the death of her child. And in fact, the investigating officer admitted to such. The prosecutor made such comments consistent therewith during the trial, and Ms. Montoya adamantly denied any such conduct during any of her interviews.
Any such conduct or any intent?
Any intent, Your Honor. She admitted to the engaging in the conduct for which she was ultimately charged and convicted under 28707 sub, which is she was charged under sub 8, and it was our position that she should have been charged and convicted under sub 6 and 9.
Was there intent to engage in the conduct?
I think a reasonable inference from the evidence is that she intended to engage in the conduct for which the child was injured. I cannot stand before this court and suggest that she that somehow the act of throwing the child into the bed on more than one occasion was in fact some sort of pure accident. I don't think a fair reading of the record would support that. Notwithstanding this 2012 amendment, however, that she, like I said, she was charged and went to trial and was charged based upon a knowing and intentional component of that statute, which is sub 1 and sub 8. The issue before the court on various occasions in various different formats, whether it be in the form of the plea and abatement, motion to quash, amended motion to quash, or the at trial, was the issue of general intent versus specific intent. And it is our position that in the 2012 amendment clearly resulted in an amendment to that statute such that that statute is now a specific intent statute. Otherwise, every crime for which the defendant engages in conduct that is intentional, and one can robotically go down the list and find the injury, then defines the crime, and we do not believe that's what was intended by the legislature.
In fact, what language in the statute would you point to that supports this argument?
The language in the statute under paragraph 1, which is the what I would call the intent part of the statute rather than the harm part of the statute. Paragraph 1 refers to knowingly, intentionally, or negligently causing or permitting a minor child to be, and then the various elements, which is in this case either A, B, or C, namely A and B, that the modification of the intent modifies the act, which then modifies the harm, which is also consistent, Your Honor, with the prior case law that's in place by this court, where there were references, albeit arguably dicta, that suggested that the harm was both an element of the intent and the harm.
I'm still not clear on which language in the statute you are suggesting supports your interpretation.
The language in the statute, in my opinion, under paragraph 1, provides for three ways of engaging in conduct, which then modifies paragraphs A, B, or C, which then modifies the harm, which is in paragraphs 3 through 8.
Nothing about paragraph 1 was amended in 2012.
I would not disagree with the fact that it was not amended specifically in paragraph 1. However, it is not, as the trial court suggested, such just a simple rearrangement of the categories of offenses, because in fact what we know from the 2012 amendment is that the purpose behind that amendment was designed, at least in part, to address shaken baby cases. Shaken baby cases are intentional in nature. They're intentional in nature in the sense that the act is intentional, the harm is unintentional. And one cannot reconcile that amendment with the trial court's conclusion, which is based upon the state's position, that 28707 is simply a general intent statute, and one simply needs to go find the harm, and you arrive at the penalty.
So does your argument hinge on legislative history and not really the text?
Yeah, I would not confess that, because that would lead to the conclusion that the statutory language is unambiguous, which would not allow this court to then go to the legislative history. It's my position that the court has to read the entire statutory scheme in whole to determine the intent of the legislature as a whole. And when reading that statute as a whole, it is subject to debate among learned individuals as to whether that is a general intent crime or a specific intent crime.
What is the textual ambiguity upon which you are relying?
The textual ambiguity, Your Honor, is based largely in paragraph 1, in the sense that the knowingly, intentionally, or negligently component, when it modifies the conduct under paragraph A, in this case A and B, it's impossible to know whether or not that intent element requires only to intend to engage in the conduct, or the intent to engage and to intend to cause the result.
So, counsel, this court, in construing the assault statute and the assault on an officer statute, has specifically held that the intent that the statute requires, the mens rea element, applies only to the prohibited conduct and not to the resulting harm. Why would the child abuse statute be construed any different way?
Because of the amendment in 2012, which we know was based upon the concern that there were crimes occurring that fell within the negligent misdemeanor statute and did not was not afforded the proper and serious nature of the crime that the state believed warranted. To include the gross negligence under paragraph 6 and 9, that's the only logical conclusion, because otherwise there would have been no need to amend the statute in 2012. I see I'm about out of time. I'll reserve the rest of my time and ask the court to reverse the trial court.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
Grab some water.
Please, the court. My name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. primary issues on appeal revolve around Section 28707, statute defining various child abuse offenses. As I understand it, Montoya basically argues that intentional child abuse resulting in death requires an intent to kill, and that were that not the case, 28707 would be unconstitutional on various grounds, both facially and as applied. As set forth in my brief, however, I think his argument is without merit. Based on the relevant statutory language, intentional child abuse resulting in death does not require an intent to kill, that it requires only an intent to commit the act of child abuse, which then results in the death of the child. Additionally, reading the relevant statutory language in that manner does not create any constitutional problems in our view. Accordingly, and because his other raised issues on appeal likewise are without merit, we ask this court to affirm the judgment below. So much of his argument, you know, comes back to the language of 28707. As I read 28707, subsection 1 defines the offense of child abuse. Subsections 3 through 8 then say, well, if that offense was done intentionally, or knowingly, or negligently, then based on the resulting harm, this is the classification of the offense as, you know, a various misdemeanor, 2A felony, 1B felony, etc. Nowhere in there, in that language, is there a reference to an intent to kill. This court has, not repeatedly, but has held, in fact, that there is no intent to kill. State v. Molina, specifically, this court stated, child abuse resulting in death requires proof of the defendant's intent to commit child abuse, as defined in the subsections of 28707 sub 1, but it does not require proof that the defendant intended to kill the minor child. I think that's dispositive. Defendant's argument or retort in argument in report is basically, A, the changes in 2010 and 2012 changed that it somehow changed it to a specific intent crime, that an intent to kill is required. That's not how I read the legislative history. That's not how the district court read the legislative history. I think the district court's order on the plea and abatement is comprehensive, covers most everything there, and I don't have much to add to that.
Do you think there's cause to look at the legislative history?
Frankly, no. The language to me is clear. As I said, sub 1 defines the offense. Subsections 3 through 8 say if it's committed intentionally or negligently, then based on the resulting harm or lack of harm, here's what it's classified as.
So the result, it is what it is.
Right.
But you have to find the initial act.
Yes. Intent to commit the act of child abuse is all that's required, either negligently or knowingly, intentionally. Then you look at the result, what happened, and that classifies the offense. As for the arguments regarding the alleged unconstitutionality of the statute, as the district court noted and as I noted in my brief, I think all of his arguments, whether equal protection, due process, void for vagueness, what have you, all based on the same foundational premise that there's no distinction, essentially, as I understand it, no distinction between a negligent act of child abuse and intentional act of child abuse. We disagree. I think that distinction is a real and meaningful one. The district court, that as well, cited several examples, in our opinion, distinguishing, you know, the two instances where it might be negligent versus intentional child abuse. And so we think because the foundational premise of his arguments is wrong, his arguments fail. As for the remaining assigned errors and issues on appeal, motion to suppress, voluntariness of statements, excessive sentence, unless this court has questions about those, I would submit it on the brief. Feel comfortable doing that.
When the investigators questioning, were there some suggestions of leniency or some threats made to the defendant? And if so, how would you respond to how that should affect our analysis?
I don't think so. Again, the district court did a pretty good job on this issue as well, in my opinion. Viewed in context, I think it was more moral exhortation to tell the truth. It was, hey, if you lie to me, it's not good for you, kind of common sense conclusions. This court in State v. McLean explained that any promises of leniency had to be specific, identifiable promises. Hear him saying that telling the truth makes, you know, me want to work with you better does not fit that requirement in our view. And regardless, the overarching question is, was her will overborne? Or was her confession, her statements involuntary? I think a review of the video recordings shows that, in fact, her statements were completely voluntary. Her will was not overborne, so I don't see any due process issue in admitting those statements at trial. Unless there are any further questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 57 seconds, Mr. Temple.
Thank you. As a follow-up to the questioning about the ambiguity, I would refer the court to Exhibit 14 in the record, which is the underlying Lancaster County case that gave rise to the 2012 amendment. The pleadings, the jury instructions are contained therein. In that case, dealing with judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and a result that was deemed intolerable by the state is what led to the 2012 amendment. And had the issue and had the statutory language been as clear as what the state posits, that case would not have been ultimately been decided the way it was and would not given rise to the 2012 amendments.
The 2012 amendment did not amend the section of the statute you say is ambiguous. Is that correct?
That would be accurate. There was no substantive changes to subparagraph 1, although the definition of negligently in paragraph 9 refers back to paragraph 1, which is contained therein, which did import a criminal negligence standard. With that, I would say I'm out of time. I'd ask the court to reverse the decision.
Thank you very much.